Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, and welcome once again to My Time Capsule. My name's Mike Fenton Stevens, and My Time Capsule is the podcast where people tell me five things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish and one thing that they wish they could bury and forget. My guest in this episode is Professor Sophie Scott. Sophie is a British neuroscientist. She's the director of the Institute for Cognitive Neuroscience, and her research investigates the cognitive neuroscience of voices, speech, and laughter, particularly speech perception, production, vocal emotions, and human communication. Sophie started her research career in Cambridge at the Medical Research Council Cognition and Brain Science Unit. Yeah, you all know that one. She was awarded a Wellcome Trust Fellowship in 2001 and has been funded by them ever since. As of 2017, she holds a Wellcome Trust Senior Fellowship, and she is a member of the British Psychological Society, the Society for Neuroscience, the Cognitive Neuroscience Society, and the Experimental Psychology Society. She's also a fellow of the British Academy. Sophie is known for her public engagement work, including performing stand-up comedy. She's been a panel guest several times on the BBC Radio 4 programme The Infinite Monkey Cage and appeared on the BBC TV series Horizon, The Science of Laughter, with Jimmy Carr. Sophie presented the Royal Institution Christmas Lecture in 2017, entitled The Language of Life, which explored the topic of communication. She's published several books, including The Brain, 10 Things You Should Know. She's a fellow of the British Academy and was awarded a CBE in the 2020 Birthday Honours for services to neuroscience. So that's Professor Sophie. Yep, daunting, isn't it? So you can imagine how much out of my depth I felt asking Sophie to tell me the five things from her amazing life she'd like to have in a time capsule. Of course, I needn't have worried. Sophie is a delight, as I'm sure you'll discover now. Here is Professor Sophie Scott.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, great. Well, I'm not right. I've got a bloody cold.
Oh, no.
Oh, what a pain they are.
And you're in rehearsals as well, so you're not going to get much of a break. I'm sorry.
I am absolutely in the middle of rehearsals, which is dancing and singing. The last thing you want to do when you've got a chest infection.
Yes, literally, quite precisely.
My wife keeps saying, go to the doctors. You might need antibiotics or something. And I said, I've got time to go to the doctors.
Yes.
I've got important things to do. I'm going to talk to Sophie this morning. It's fantastic. It's really lovely of you to do this. Thank you so much for giving me your time.
Very kind of you to invite me. It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
No, it's fascinating. I've got a wife who's a PhD, so I've got a doctor wife, and I've got a doctor son-in-law. I'm the only non-qualified person in the whole house, it seems, you know. And I always think that when you talk to someone about their world and about their specialist thing, it's always fascinating. And I've looked at things that you've done, and I've ordered the book because it looked fantastic.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
No, it's exactly the sort of thing I like to read, though. It is exactly the sort of thing.
Yeah.
Those things, they take me off into a different world, and I like it a lot. So I'm looking forward to that. That will be my train journeys for a bit.
Excellent. It's a fast read. It's written as short essays, so it should be. You're not making a big commitment. Hours.
And what led you to write it then?
I was approached about it, and I thought I would be really irritated if somebody else wrote this. I want to write it. Because it's one of a series. There's 10 things you need to know about space and maths and the deep sea, dinosaurs. And I thought this is a chance for me to write something that I've always wanted to write. And I've been teaching and giving talks about brains for so long. And people often ask for recommendations, and there's nothing I could think of that quite always lands. So it's either too technical or much too general.
Yeah.
And I thought nothing's kind of sitting in the space where you kind of need to zoom out a bit to think about. To understand the brains we have now, you do need to think about where they come from. Otherwise, none of it makes sense. They're just impenetrably complex. So that's what I tried to do here. So we go into brains and then we go right back to sort of where in evolution they appear from.
Yeah, absolutely. That fascinating thing is that we have those areas that clearly we're in control of, and we use that part of the brain for thinking and reasoning and making decisions. And then there's another part of the brain which is just happening from a really animal instinctive way.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, there's almost like it's a sort of hierarchy, and you can see it in terms of how the brain is structured, and you can see it in terms of your own experience. And if you're walking down the street and you trip, by the time you've had time to think, I am falling, your brainstem areas have also very often kind of corrected that, and you've stumbled, but you've remained upright. And if you waited for consciousness to sort out that problem, you'd be lying on the pavement thinking, oh, I have now fallen. So often you could just kind of go around through life without being aware of it. Every so often things happen and you think, oh, that's, yeah, okay, there are different elements to this. There's different layers to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm particularly interested in talking to you about it because I have a granddaughter who has been diagnosed with autism and PDA. A PDA is pathological demand avoidance syndrome.
Right.
Which is not very well known at all, but is absolutely now a completely accepted syndrome. And it means that quite often her being told to do something, she reacts to it in an animal way. She reacts in the fight or flight mode.
Yeah. It's enough for the requirement to be there and she's already panicking.
Yeah. And her sensible brain, as it were, her cognitive brain, is aware that that's not a threat. But the other side of it overwhelms it.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, well, I hope that she does okay. She's getting some help.
She is getting help now, yes. It's taken a while because those sort of disabilities are still catching up with other sorts of disabilities in the way that people handle them.
Oh, totally. And even the sort of, we still don't really know. With something like autism, we don't know why it happens. We don't know really what the implications are for brain development and what it. We're still trying to find the best ways of characterising what it means to be an autistic person.
Yeah.
And with all of these developmental differences, the phrase you keep hearing is heterogeneity. And what it means is that people can have the same diagnosis but have very, very different experiences.
Yes, extraordinary.
And often they overlap. So with things like dyspraxia, problems of movement, and dyslexia, you might have a child who's diagnosed as dyslexic or dyspraxic, and then you test them for the other thing and they'll have that as well.
Yeah.
You know, so people with a diagnosis of dyslexia also often have dyspraxic issues. So it's almost like, which part of this are you focusing on, or do you need to zoom out and actually look at a whole picture more?
Yes, it's weird as well because it's always been compared as something outside of the norm.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, defining the norm is almost impossible, isn't it?
I mean, well, it's extremely easy to define the norm. That doesn't mean to say you've actually done it right. So I think that's one of the problems with psychology is that finding that norm's very easy. It's just, is that what kind of norm is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very interesting how we never talk about that, do we? How do we think? We never talk to other people about how we think. You just assume that other people do the same thing. For example, just yesterday, I said to my grandson, so that's 54 at 18, what's that? And he went, 54, 65. And I could see him go at the 10.
Yeah.
Then add 4 to 8, because that's easier than 8 to 4.
Yeah.
He switched it round. So 4 to 8, yes, that's 12. Add those on. So and that's how he did it. He did a sum by breaking it down into simple things. And my wife next, I said, do you see what he's done? And she said, I don't know what he's doing at all. I can't understand it. And I said, do you not do that with maths? Do you not break it down into simple sums? And she said, no.
Yeah.
Completely different.
It is absolutely fascinating. I was... Can I name drop wildly? I was talking to Lauren Laverne. I do the Maths of Life as a stand-in for Hannah Fry every so often. And we were talking about aphantasia, which is people who don't have any visual imagery, which I don't have. Right. And, you know, I was quite old before I found out other people did. I have no idea what it means to be able to imagine a scene in your head. So my partner and I can both remember the same event where he said something very witty. And I remember the witty thing he said. And generally what we were doing, and he knows who was there, what they looked like, what they were wearing, where they were sitting. And I can't begin to,
you know.
And just in the course of this discussion, Lauren mentioned that she has no inner monologue.
Right.
She does not think in words. So she's obviously thinking. So she's sort of insensible or not conscious. But a great deal of psychology or sort of arguments around thought and the relationship between thought and consciousness. Like I said, you know, you're walking down the street and you trip and you think I'm falling. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people don't think that.
Right.
It's not an absolutely universal experience. And some people don't experience in it. So I experience an inner monologue as almost like printed words. I don't hear a voice.
Yeah.
Unless things get really emotional, when often it starts to sound like my voice. And then often it ends up with me saying, shut up, Sophie, or something, you know, actually come to speak. And other people experience it as other people talking.
Right.
Or, and there may be a multitude of people. You know, you may hear many voices. So actually the content of other people's subjective experience of being them is not the same. I have very poor visual imagery, but I have excellent auditory imagery. There's always a song playing in my head all the time. Mm. And Gonia found out recently that's not true for most people. So understanding that individual variation just within that, let's call it the normal population, is something we're just starting to kind of scrape at, because I think we, you know, kind of try and get the edges that try and understand that, because I think we haven't engaged with that at all. And maybe that's because a certain sort of person goes into the science of studying humans and maybe they do all have good visual imagery. That's certainly what I'm being unfair. Most people do seem to have visual imagery, good visual imagery, but maybe they have a particular way of thinking that means that that sort of nature of their monologue becomes what they think everyone has.
Yes, I love that variation, though. I love that. I mean, otherwise, we'd all be thinking the same thing almost, wouldn't we?
Exactly.
The fact that we have these people, that people in history have thought of things that now we all accept because they've been explained to us.
Yeah.
But we don't see it initially. Our heads don't accept it. And yet somebody just went, the world's round.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of the things I love about humans and their brains, actually, is that in addition to all this variation, just the sheer inventiveness and sort of novelty-seeking of the human brain means we change the world around us and we invent things that help us change the world or change how we do things. And our brains just adapt to that. And then we very often invent new things to do with that thing.
Yeah.
And we just adapt. So brains are incredibly plastic. I mean, it is a bit daunting to think this. But as far as we can see, there has been no big evolutionary differences between the appearance of modern humans and now, which means that if you were a baby growing up and you somehow zoomed them over a few hundreds of thousands of years into our culture now, they wouldn't necessarily grow up any differently because their genes are the same. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So we're always a mix of you know, we spend a long time in development and we train our big brains up in that period of development. So you adapt to the environment in which you grow up and your brain is shaped by that. But that's not a bug, it's a feature.
Wow.
And it's what sort of enables the development of human sort of culture and all the things we just, you know, you don't even think about, like the pen as a piece of technology, but it's an amazing piece of technology that's made. Or as soon as you've got a pen and you can write things down in the world, your memory is no longer just what's in your head.
Yeah.
So we can store information out there. And that's something that's happened fairly early in human, not you know, it took us a while to get to that, but it sort of changes everything. And then you just adapt to it. And we just assume now that everything we know isn't what's in our head. It's out there in books and it's on the internet. And your brain evolves alongside it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you think about all those things. I had a friend who said to me that when he hears music, he sees colours.
Synesthesia, amazing.
And you go, what? That's amazing.
Yeah.
And people say to me, how do you learn lines? And I say, I mean, I get to the point where my brain is actually just giving it to me without me thinking about it. So yeah. I'm not thinking about what's the next line. It just comes out of my head because I've done it so many times. Yeah. But if I ever get to the point where I think, oh, it's not giving me the word, what is it? Yeah. I can go back and sort of visualize the page. I can see the page, the printed page, and I can see the coffee stains on it. I actually know it. I've taken a photograph of it in my head.
Yeah.
And I can look over it to the point where I need to be and go, ah, that's it. And then I carry on.
Yeah.
Strange. I wonder if that's strange or not. I've not really discussed it with people.
Well, statistically, and bearing in mind we don't know what the norms are necessarily, but there seem to be more people out there who have good visual imagery or even fantastically good visual imagery, which it sounds like you have. If you can see the page and then get to where you need to be on the page, you have very good visual imagery.
Right.
They hyperphantasics, that's what they're called, as opposed to me who's an aphantasic. And that means that you do seem to remember things differently and you've got different access to. So if you test people on eyewitness testimony, you find that the people with hyperphantasia will provide more detail, although they don't necessarily remember thing any better. So the details of the actual events aren't different between the two groups, but the hyperphantasics will bring in more information around it. So what actually happened isn't different. It's not that the aphantasics can't remember, but you get more information with the hyperphantasics.
Oh, amazing. I'm going to have to ask people now. I'm going to go. Yes. I've got rehearsals today, so I shall say to people, how do you do it?
Yeah.
And then we'll find out. I love being hyperphantasic, though. It's a great description. So, Sophie, we're going to talk about some things you've chosen from your life.
Yes.
They sort of treasure, four of them that you treasure, really, and one that you'd like to forget.
Yes.
But I'd be fascinated to find out what they are.
So my first thing would be a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And that's for I've cheated here slightly. It's for a couple of different reasons. So the first is I do really love sound. And we had a reel-to-reel tape recorder when I was a kid. They were not unusual things for people to have in the sort of 60s and 70s.
No.
I mean, I'd heard of people who used them to record things. But what you often just did with them was play around with them and record each other's voices and, you know, record little plays. My brother and sister and I were always sort of recording ourselves, making a radio program or something, or recreating scripts. And that was, it was a lovely thing, they're lovely physical things that, and it sort of took it for granted. But the thing that it sort of, I realised when I was thinking about this very kind invitation, that was probably the first time that I got obsessed with sound and thinking about sound and sort of playing with sound. And that inadvertently, that's what I've ended up doing for a living. So I'm interested in, I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. I look at the human brain, but what I look at in the human brain is how it does things with sound. I'm interested in how we hear sounds and I'm interested in how we make sounds. So what we're doing right now, we think of that as talking, but what we're actually doing is making noises at each other that have linguistic properties. And it's not the only thing we can do with our voices. We can sing, we can beatbox, we are amazing vocal mimics, and we have a lot of different ways of engaging with the world with sound. We, you know, music, again, we think of as an entirely different sort of world from spoken language, but it's all still sound.
Yes.
And I think that's the reason, the main reason I would put that in there is because it's this kind of route into a world of sounds and what they mean. And of course, it's so recent. When Edison invented the phonograph, he thought it would be a way of recording voices of people so you'd have something of them after they died. And that is true. That is a thing you can do with it. But no one saw that being used primarily as a way of having recordings of music.
No.
Because music was a live thing. Why would you want a recording of it? But of course, as soon as you have recordings of music, then that makes the way that most people engage with things like pop music.
Yeah.
Most people weren't engaging with that as a live phenomenon. It was a record that they bought or something that you stream. It's a noise.
Sheet music, in fact.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
The success of a song was regarded as how many pieces of sheet music did you sell?
Yes, yes. And you get that kind of flip from sheet music to recorded music because you can have recorded music. That's a physical, it's this thing. You can then go away and play the record flat. So there's something very interesting about that kind of, well, many, many other things come from that. And my science is a very new science. So people weren't studying voices in the way that we can do now 200 years ago because you couldn't.
No.
You couldn't record a sound. So there were people doing phonetics. And, you know, if you watch My Fair Lady, the main character is sort of driven by examples of scientists at UCL where I work who were studying sort of the phonetics of the human voice and started to break it down. But their ways of recording that were still very elementary and very basic. So it's it's a new kind of area of science to be working, relatively new, but it's all made possible by the fact that we could actually record it.
Yes, those early recordings are all people saying, Mary had a little lamb. You know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? And then the speed which it develops. I loved having a reel-to-reel when I was a young man. Yeah, we had one in the house. My brother filled it almost entirely, my older brother filled it almost entirely with classical music. I don't think he ever listened to it, but I think he felt that it was something that deserved it.
Yes, yes. And one of the things that that still happens is that people find old reel-to-reel tapes on car boot sales and find people who've recorded radio programmes on there that were thought to be lost.
Yeah.
There's some Hancocks recently, weren't there? That
there were, yeah. Way.
And I love that. These things are sitting there like little, or their own little time capsule. And you have no way of knowing what's on it until you sit down and listen to 3 hours of it. And there could be something magical in there.
Yes. Yes, I remember a friend of mine saying that he'd found a box of reel-to-reels outside his office in what was called the Comedy Corridor. So he was a BBC radio producer in comedy. And there was a box of tapes outside and they said to be reused.
Wow.
They were old shows that the BBC had said, well, we don't need these anymore.
Yeah.
So one of them was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Wow.
And it was the original tape.
Wow.
I know.
That's incredible. And just think they could just have been lost just like that.
Well, also, there wasn't that sense that you were keeping a record of things. You know, we'd done it, we'd put it out. Yes. What would we hang on to it?
Yes, yes. It's not seen as a sort of legacy item.
No.
No, absolutely.
Whereas now everything is stored. Everything is put somewhere.
Which does lead me to my other reason why I really like reel-to-reel tape recorders.
Right.
I am an obsessive, I have like an obsessive interest in Richard Nixon. For all my life, probably because Watergate was the first kind of story in the news that I remember really being like a thing. I didn't know what he meant, but it was suddenly everywhere. And I would have been kind of 5, 6 years old and just starting to be aware of things. But the kind of utter hubris of the tape recorders recording everything, which Richard Nixon thought that would venerate, you know, kind of actually prove him right about people being out to get him. That's why he reinstated the tape recording system, which he had removed when he came in. And it was really late on in the whole Watergate process, like when someone mentioned it in one of the Senate hearings, and it was only after that they stopped recording. It was absolutely amazing, just amazing. And then you have this kind of prolonged battle between the people trying to find out what had happened here and Richard Nixon and his office trying to prevent the tapes being handed over because they tried to sequester them and they really, really wouldn't. There were fantastic things like Richard Nixon said he would hand them over, but only to a particular senator who was allowed to listen to them and then make notes on them and hand them over. And that particular senator was deaf. Just amazing. And then, of course, when they do get handed over, there's the fantastic 18 and a half minutes of silence, which I have actually, this is how completely obsessed with it I got. I did find a copy of this silence and download it and did some acoustic analysis on it. I am not the first person. But what's fascinating about that is that it's not silent. It's full of multiple different noises. And because somebody has on a reel-to-reel tape recorder tried to go back and delete something.
God.
Which, of course, was really... Well, all you could do to delete things was to press play and record and re-record. Yeah. Exactly. So what you hear is the room noise and sort of transformers that weren't quite working properly, so you got a lot of hum, and the clunk, click of somebody starting and stopping the thing that goes on for 18 and a half minutes. And some people have suggested, because no one knows who did the deletions, there were multiple deletions, some people have suggested that he was so technically inept that could only have been Richard Nixon. But it's not quite it's not quite the smoking gun you're looking for, is it?
Wow, and there is, of course, a possibility that eventually, as with all these things, like DNA, we will find how to reverse that.
There have been a couple of engineering, so acoustics people like me, but who work on the engineering side of things, who were involved in a couple of separate analyses, and the tapes are actually still held in controlled conditions.
Right.
In case there is some development that means that so the current understanding is there's really nothing you can get back off it because the tapes are magnetic. And when you re-record, you re-magnetize the tape. So you're truly overwriting.
Right.
But
you never know.
You don't know.
No.
So it's all being held just on the off chance something occurs.
I wonder if they can recover WhatsApp messages.
Well, unless you hurl your phone into the sea.
Yes, quite.
It's possible. Sorry, drop it in the sea.
Drop, yeah.
By taking interesting photographs of the North Coast. because it is an interesting kind of comparison. So those tape recorders were voice activated and they were in the Oval Office in different places. And I think the phone lines in the White House. So it was happening all the time. As soon as people started talking, this stuff would click in. And now, of course, we're in a situation in a digital world where stuff, once it's out there, it doesn't get taped over. It's there forever, potentially. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different ways in which we leave traces of what we've said and what we've done.
Yeah.
I mean, you're still not allowed to bunk somebody without their notice, but lots of other ways are digital privacy. I went to a presentation about advertising for radio, which, of course, has exploded with the streaming and digital opportunities. And this person was saying with real enthusiasm how you could tell, based on people's movements using their mobile phone, when they'd heard an advert for a particular kind of mobile phone, how many of those people had then gone into a shop that sold those mobile phones to find out more about it. And they were saying, wow, that this was a good thing. And I thought, my God, that's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
That kind of granularity of your actions being mapped between where you are and what you're listening to. And so, we live in a very different kind of world in terms of privacy.
Yes, we do. I mean, this very podcast, like all podcasts, the people who put them out know a lot more about everybody who listens to them and will specifically design the adverts that are on it to go with the people who listen to it. And that's just the beginning, surely.
Yeah, and obviously there's many good things to that. You know, it's just the sort of the flip side of it that's the thing that's a bit like, oh, hang on, I really am always telling people a lot about myself and what I'm doing.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, how fascinating. Yes, what a brilliant thing to put in. Obviously, I'd rather hear your childhood plays than I would Richard Nixon. But how lovely. We'll put that into the time capsule. That's number one, Sophie.
Fantastic.
So what's number two?
Number two is the sound of my partner laughing. And it's for a couple of different reasons. So first of all, he does laugh very, you know, if you love your partner, it's likely the case that you find their laughter charming. But he laughs, you know, well. He laughs in his sleep, which I find very, very, very endearing. I haven't shared a bedroom with many people. I don't know how many people do this, but I've never heard of it happening before. No. And I like the thought that he's having happy dreams. he also, apparently like his own father, he has a laugh where you can really push him over into sort of starting to choke and lose it. And that's very rewarding. And my father, he was a funny man. He liked comedy and he was very good at making people laugh. You could see this glint come into my father's eyes when he thought he could get my partner, Tom, into that state. And if you could see it, or you could see it like kind of like, okay, I'm going to get there. And he'd watch him like a hawk and then keep going until he was, you know, coughing and choking and spluttering and unable to breathe. It was very lovely.
It's amazing, isn't it, that we haven't learned to control that. It's a very dangerous thing. If you're driving or you're involved in something important and that overtakes you, it really does overtake you. It wipes everything else out. You can't breathe, you can't think, you can't see.
You can't move.
No.
So there are. I have actually ended up studying this as part of my interest in human voices. I've done quite a lot of work on laughter.
Right.
And if you look at people when they're laughing, there's a suppression of what are called K reflexes. And K reflexes are the things that, they're sort of muscle reflexes that keep you, say, if you're sitting in your chair, it's what keeps you upright.
Yeah.
If you're standing up, it stops you from just falling over. So lots of continual little adjustments that are making sure you don't just slide onto the floor. And as soon as you start laughing, those get suppressed. And that's why you start getting really floppy and weak. And we do say rolling on the floor laughing. That's the direction of travel. That's
I've
where you're
seen
going,
it so. Happen. I saw it at the National Theatre when I was a young man. A man behind me fell out of his seat into the aisle laughing.
How rewarding. It's glorious, isn't it?
Fantastic.
And it has this, it's in an, as you say, in an evolutionary sense, it's completely ridiculous. If a tiger walks in at that point,
yeah,
there'd be nothing momentarily that you could do about it.
No, particularly as we tend to laugh in dangerous situations.
Exactly. A stressful situation is one of the best ways of setting up some laughter. And the other thing that's interesting is that there does seem to be, and this is obviously, it's very hard to do these studies, but it's something that we're looking at now. There does seem to be two kinds of laughter that exist for humans and maybe for some other animals. And that is that kind of absolutely helpless, you can't stop. The sort of, on that clip from Test Match Special when Ron Johnson and Jonathan Agnew, you know, oh, Aggers, do stop it. Well, the reason he keeps saying, oh, Aggers, do stop it, is because they're just making each other laugh, and they're laughing very helplessly. And you need they're going to get in trouble. The BBC doesn't like sports broadcasters doing this.
No.
By the end, when he says, "I've stopped laughing," that's because the producer was glaring at him. But they can't just turn it off.
No.
Once that kind of laughter started, it's going to happen, and you're just going to have to ride it out. Well, you might be able to try and close it down, but you're not going to be able to stop it.
In a way, the attempt to close it down makes it worse, doesn't it?
Exactly, because you're thinking about the laughter. That, yeah. When James Naughtie called Jeremy Hunt something else, he then for the next minute or so sounded like he was having a fight with a pig. When he was literally fighting with his own body, all these squeaks and whistles and grunting sounds. And he said, "I'm sorry, I've got hiccups." He obviously haven't got hiccups. Yep. But that's the power of the laughter. So even though he is the closest I can find of somebody who gets through, he kept talking, but he's obviously something very severe was happening, and it was the laughter. So there's that going on, and that's really spontaneous, involuntary laughter. And then you've got the rest of the laughter that happens in your life, and that happens a lot. We laugh a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That it seems to be more like a kind of a communicative signal, and it can still feel very spontaneous and very warm. I'm not saying it's like fake laughter all the time, but a lot of the laughter that happens actually in the real world is the sort of laughter that's happened as we've been talking with each other. And there, we laugh a lot, and it's spontaneous and warm, but it stops and starts. You're not overwhelmed by it. And that seems to be under a different pattern of brain control, we think.
Right.
So you're able to sort of use that laughter in a way that has some element of intentionality, such that, for example, if you were talking to somebody you really didn't like, then it just wouldn't happen at all.
Yes. So that's a social thing, isn't it, as well? Yeah. But you're, in a way, you're saying to people, I like you, I like what you're saying, I'm not a problem, I'm on your side.
I agree, I understand.
You see, people at a party who don't know each other terribly well will talk, and they'll all laugh at each other all the time.
Yeah,
particularly the person talking will laugh a lot. That's weird, isn't it?
Well, there was a psychologist called Robert Provine who studied this starting in the 70s, and he was thought to be a complete idiot for studying laughter. People don't think it's a very serious thing to study. But he pointed out, first of all, exactly this. It's a social behaviour. You're 30 times more likely to laugh if there's somebody else with you than if you're on your own. So it just is a behaviour that's kind of primed by the presence of other people. He was a fascinating person. He said you've got to study humans like Jane Goodall studies chimps.
Right.
Don't bother getting them in the lab. Go out there and look at them. So he'd go out there and watch people having conversations. And he observed exactly what you've just said. So conversation is where most laughter happens. And during that conversation, the person who laughs most is the person who's talking. So they're using the laughter to get the people that they're talking to show they agree, they remember, they're part of the same group, they like each other. So it's a very intentional act at some level.
Yes, that group thing is, I mean, all actors know it well, because if you're in a packed theatre, you're much more likely to get a big laugh.
Yeah.
If people are spread out, dissipated, and it's not full, that not being right next to someone will affect how much you laugh.
Absolutely. There's a really interesting property of laughter, which is actually unique to humans. So we're not the only animals that laugh. You find laughter in other apes. You find it in lots of other mammals, it seems.
Right.
But only humans laugh contagiously. So there's something about laughter that can jump the gap between humans. It's something we learn to do. We don't laugh contagiously when we're babies. And there's lots of other contagious behaviours out there, like yawning and scratching, that other animals do contagiously. Contagious yawning is really common in social animals like budgerigars and turtles. You know, it's really that universal. But laughter can jump the gap between humans. And a lot of what happens in an audience environment seems to be, well, this is still something we're trying to study, but it seems to have this kind of contagious element, such that when you've got an audience of a sufficient size and they're sitting close enough to each other, when you get laughter set up, it can then start to sort of roll around the room.
Yeah.
And the dynamics of it can be very different than if you've got 45 people in a room, who might still laugh, but as soon as the laughter's happened, it then dies away again. And you've got to work to get it back up. You can't sort of get it up there and keep it up there as you might be able to do in an audience of 4,000.
Yes.
And part of that, I think, is contagion.
Mm-hmm. And a prime example of that, I think, probably is the fact that people feel when they're watching a DVD or watching a television programme that they're part of the laughter. But quite often, if you just film them watching it and cut the sound off, they laugh very rarely.
Yes.
They might smile, but they're not in that crowd. So the laughter is happening. They're appreciating it, but they're not actually taking part in it.
Exactly. You need to be in it to get that contagion. But there's a reason why we like to watch. Well, I did actually look into this. I can't find any example of a comedian who's released a DVD of their comedy set where they haven't done it in front of an audience.
Yeah.
Now, you think about it, well, we can cope with that for films. You know, we don't need to hear other people responding. No. there's something about live comedy, and I think part of that, and in fact, we did do a study on this. If you add laughter onto the ends of jokes, people will rate the joke as funnier.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be at the end. If you put the laughter at the start, it doesn't work. So that's probably working in a number of ways. First of all, that kind of contagion. It's also telling you someone else found that funny. There's something funny to be heard here. And of course, if you're the comedian on stage and you hear the audience laugh, and I've asked comedians about this, they said, well, I become funnier. So it's, you know, the whole thing's more of an interaction. And I think that's why when you are consuming comedy, not all comedy, there's plenty of stuff that doesn't have to have a laugh track, but particularly live comedy or stand-up, you get that sense of the audience because you're seeing a conversation, if you like, between a comedian and that audience. And you need that. You need both halves of it there.
Absolutely. It's what comedians call timing. It's affected by what's actually coming back at you. You will vary that timing depending on what you're getting back. Absolutely. I'd be absolutely fascinated to see if you ever did a study of what we all call, actors call, corpsing, which again is that thing being in a situation where you really shouldn't laugh.
Yeah.
And you start to laugh. And that is the worst thing. It's unbearable. And it's why we call it corpsing, because it's like dying.
There's something very interesting about that, because it seems to be, because laughter primes laughter, like contagion, it's contagious within yourself. Mm. You know, you can sort of set yourself off. Corpsing, if you think about situations where it's happened, and you mentioned earlier, like difficult situations, perhaps situations where you absolutely shouldn't be laughing, it almost seems to set it off a bit. So it's like a risk almost that this is a bad situation. So I had a very difficult situation where a colleague was going through a horrible divorce. It was really unpleasant. And there was a family court involved and she had to...
I can already feel myself laughing.
Don't. she called me up and said, look, can you come here? Because my husband's turned up with like 25 friends and I'm on my own. So I went down and it was very difficult for her. And then I called my partner, Tom. And I said, look, I know you're going to the gym, but would you mind coming as well? Because there's just two of us here and there's like 25 men and she just needs more people here. And as soon as Tom turned up, I glanced at something on my phone and it was Viz Comic on Facebook. And I think it was the Children's Poet Laureate article, which is a beautiful article about the story of the children's poetry laureate. It was like my Uncle Billy had a 10-foot willy. He'd read Prince of Wales's inauguration, things like that. But I just glanced at it, and it was entirely because he was there, and I started to laugh at this, but I became completely hysterical, and I had to go into the toilets, and I was crying with laughter in the toilets. It was absolutely overwhelming, but it was like the worst thing I could have done in that environment.
Yes.
Because of the seriousness and the severity of the situation. What we don't need is one of my two friends who are here, the only backing me up. One of them's now crying in the toilets with laughter about it. Pathetically dirty joke. But it was the lack of appropriateness and his appearance in it. So it was the two things. It was the severity of the situation, but also him being there. Mm. Probably anything would have set me off. And there's something about the way we will try and use laughter, and people will use laughter in stressful situations to try and deal with the stress. I think what often you're dealing with is sort of an extreme version of that. But it's something that happens with other people. You're not sort of you're trying to sort of get someone else to join you in the laughter at some level. And when that works, it works well.
Yes. I mean,
if the studies of married couples looking at how they deal with stressful situations, it shows this happens to be a study of married couples, which is true, I'm sure, of like many different kinds of couples. But it's couples who deal with stressful situations with what the scientists call positive affect, but they mean laughter and smiling.
Yes.
They get less stress and they stay together for longer and they're happier. But it only works if they both laugh. It's sharing the laughter where you can actually get that reduction in stress. So I think often the severity, there's a lot of things going on in those kind of stressful situations when laughter starts happening. But to go back to your point about corpsing, I think the only way around it is to get on top of it before it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So don't look at the people who might set you off. Get yourself in a different emotional state, because if laughter gets even the tiniest toehold, it will win.
Yep.
You cannot beat it.
No, been there many times, I'm afraid. Absolutely. I'm known as being quite good at dealing with it. And thinking about it, that's exactly what I do. I get angry with myself.
Yeah.
Don't you dare.
You're getting a different emotion in place,
indeed,
aren't you?
I replace it, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the laughter goes away because you're feeling something else.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Does Tom have a very natural, good laugh?
Yes, but again, yes. I mean, I love him, so I'm going to say that. But it's he has a very And I think when you like someone, you like their laugh. When you love someone, you love their laugh. It's because it's part of how you kind of express your feelings for each other, is that you laugh together. But he has a very lovely laugh. He laughs very freely with people that he likes. And, you know, when he's with his brother and sister.
Yeah, that's what I meant, really, when I said a good laugh. Yeah, when he's
with his mum or dad, you'd really hear him laugh as well. It's it's a charming thing.
Lovely. Okay, well, let's put Tom's laugh in the time capsule then. That's number two, Sophie. Right, let's move on to number three. Okay, I'm afraid we have to interrupt Sophie at this point to potentially play you some ads. We'll be back as soon as possible.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to part two of My Time Capsule with Professor Sophie Scott. Let's find out what else she's going to choose, shall we? Well, we're going to, so you might as well say yes.
My number three is the computer game Lemmings.
Right.
That's because, you know, when you get older, you sort of think about things like I've lived through a lot of like ends of things. Like, there used to be a paper chase on Tottenham Court Road. My father used to have a job in the industrial sector. You know, things event. I used to work in Our Price Records when we stopped selling vinyl. You know, you kind of see things ending, and you're like, this is just, you know, there are many things that end in life, but also you're around for things starting and you don't even necessarily notice that you're there for them. So I did a PhD starting in 1990, and that was sort of the start of people getting computers around more. So when I started my PhD at UCL in 1990, you just had a desk. There wasn't a computer on the desk. In fact, I think I had a typewriter on my desk because that's, you wanted to write something up, you'd use a typewriter. And I'd come from the Polytechnic of Central London, and I typed all my, you know, the stuff I needed to not write with my terrible handwriting was always typed. And we had computer lessons, but that meant going into the computer lab and using a BBC Micro. There wasn't, you know, wouldn't be a thought there would be something that was existing outside of the computer lab. And when I started my PhD, you wanted to use a computer. There were these enormous VAXes, which sat in, and again, in a dedicated room. And to do statistical testing on that, what you had to do was open a file, write your own code for the statistics, then type in manually every single data point, and then press go. And that's how you find out if there was a problem with any of those stages. Like, had you mistyped the code? Had you missed out a number? There was no other way of finding out. And then we got a computer in each office, and they were shared between like three or four PhD students, but there was a Windows PC. And this was unbelievable. You could now do word processing. There was a word processing machine in the building. We had to book time on it. That's how hard it was.
Yeah.
And this still wasn't on your desk. It was a, you know, it was a shared machine, but you could, you know, when your colleagues weren't on that, well, you could write up your assignments. You could start writing your PhD. You know, it was still largely in a world where you were writing stuff down mostly in notebooks, but there was this thing for doing your computing on. And then by the end of my PhD, we had one on each desk. We each had our own machine. It was unbelievable. But that also meant there were other things you could do on that computer.
Mm-hmm. And in those days, not porn.
Not porn.
No.
Imagine that loading very slowly on.
And then being really disappointed. I know.
And that was my entry into the world of computer games. My brother had like a ZX80 and a ZX81 where you could play those sort of computer games where you said, oh, you're in a dark room and you're typing walk north. I was like, all right, I guess. But there were games like, I had a demo version of Ultima Underworld and a computer game called Gods, which is still, I think, probably my favourite sort of, it wasn't even 3D. You just moved around to a 2D character, Gods character. But Lemmings was just amazing. And it was the thing that we played it very socially. So people would all, let's all get together and play Lemmings, you know, turn that one into a blocker, turn that one into a digger. So you had these little lemmings and you basically, they were being released one at a time into an environment and you had to save them. And the only way that you could save them was by turning the lemmings into different sorts of characters. You could do things like build a little stairs, or they could dig a hole, or they could dig a hole in different angles, or they could climb up things. And as you go through the world, it gets harder and harder and harder. Yeah. And it's simply a very, very engaging game. And it was a very, didn't have a computer at home. It would have been unimaginable to have a computer at home, but it was the sort of the, if you wanted to stop working on your PhD, but somehow remain seated in the computer, it was a way of using your mind very differently around that. And it was just, I loved it. I just loved it. In fact, I recently bought an old portable PlayStation because you can still get discs for that on which you can play an original version of Lemmings. There are other things that have come along where people have copied it, but it's not the original. And I want the original. I want the way they move and the way that they go, oh no, when they explode. That's what I want.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievably basic. It could not. I try and show it to my son and he's like, why are you doing this? So that it stands for that, and for the PhD, and for my genuine affection for all those really early computer games, which is now like a massive industry and it's a world of stuff. It's where, like, for my son, who's nearly 18, like, computer games are his, what music was for me as a teenager, you know. Yeah. It's what you discuss with your friends. It's what you do with your friends. A lot of your kind of cultural references are built around that. And it's a great thing. So I was sort of seeing a very early thing that blossomed into a much, much larger phenomenon, but still kind of love the really simple early stuff.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about Lemmings, but I played it as well. And it's a great way to sort of... I wonder, when you're in the midst of something very complicated and very detailed, that in fact your brain can hardly leave alone because you're always thinking about it, that you need those really simple distractions to turn yourself off.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think one of the things that, like you say, with Lemmings, it was very accessible. So I gave a copy of it to my mum and dad when they finally got a computer at home. They were both obsessed with it. So it's very transparent how to do this. But it makes you think differently. And I think just like doing a Wordle now, or, you know, it's just a way of taking your brain off and doing something else with it.
Yeah.
With the added attraction that you can explode everybody if you decide that this isn't working.
Quite. My wife always says that when she did her PhD, she had to put so much information into her brain that she sort of pushed a lot of other stuff to the place where she has trouble accessing it now. So she can't remember holidays with our kids.
Mm.
She can't remember all sorts of things that happened before she started her PhD.
Oh, interesting.
She sort of filled her brain.
Yeah.
And yet still, University Challenge comes on, something happens and she just shouts it out. And then goes, God, I haven't thought about that for 30 years.
I think that's often the way with memory. As far as we can see, there is no limit to the amount of information a human brain can store.
Right.
So all computers on Earth, there is a point where they're full up. Because human memory is dynamic and you encode information into what you already know. You don't store it as a new file.
No.
That means that we're literally storing information differently and not necessarily always accurately, but it's not, there's no known limit to it. What the limit is access.
Right.
And exactly like you say with your wife, so she might have difficulty recalling it in one context, but as soon as Jeremy Paxman is asking some hapless individual about it on television, it's there.
Yeah.
She's getting to it via a different route. So it's one of the interesting things about memory is how you can sort of jolt yourself into a recall that you had no idea was even possible.
Yeah. Just earlier on, you were talking about how having songs going in your head the whole time, music going in your head. Mm. And I have rhymes. Mm. Perhaps I should have done poetry. I don't know, but bad rhymes.
Really?
Yeah, a word is said, I instantly try and think of a rhyme for it.
That's really interesting.
And I do it with my grandchildren. They say things and then I make up little rhymes using those words.
So is it novel stuff or is it stuff that you've heard before?
No,
is it
novel. Always new.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Does it feel almost compulsive? Is it something that you can remember doing from a young age? Those are two different
absolutely.
Questions.
Often I'm not even aware that I'm doing it.
Yeah.
No, so you said feel. I thought the word ill.
Yeah. And when's the first time you can remember doing it?
My father did it. So really? I wonder if, in fact, I learnt it from him or, in fact, inherited it. I don't know which, but my father was an inveterate rhymer.
Yeah.
So I've done it as well. And I wonder if it's almost as a tribute to him, you know, that I just copied him.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know which way it is.
Oh, that is really interesting.
Mm. But it's an example, isn't it, of we just don't know what's going on in other people's heads.
Yes. Very different land to live in your head. Exactly. Yeah.
Fabulous. Okay, well, let's put lemmings in.
Brilliant.
There they are, all going, oh, no.
Oh, no.
And exploding. wonderful. Right, we've got two left, Sophie. So we've got a good one or a bad one, whichever you want to do in whichever order.
I will do my bad one.
Okay.
So what can go into the ground and be buried and never, ever, ever come up again?
Yes.
Is a Hugo Zastava van. I've had a happy life. And this is despite a Hugo Zastava van. There aren't many things that I really hate, but I did have for a few years when I was finishing my PhD and when I was first working in Cambridge, so I had to commute in it.
Mm.
I had a Hugo Zastava van that had been bought by Tom's mum as a gift. And it was a van, so the insurance was for a vehicle that was being used for commercial purposes. The insurance mm-hmm. was a lot. And it was at a time when, let's just say, Hugo's didn't enjoy tremendous build quality. So it's being adapted very poorly from a left-hand drive vehicle. They just sort of moved everything over, but hadn't moved over the wiring. So the clutch ran forward and through a hole and then back again. So the clutch was just being kind of seesawed back and forth across a metal piece of metal and then would break because there was it was going to break. There was no other way. Yeah. It was designed to break the clutch. It was built in. It had incredibly good full beam. So I was commuting. I was working in Cambridge and living outside Cambridge and coming up and down to London. And, you know, there weren't well-lit roads outside Cambridge at that time, and I had quite a long commute home. So I was often driving in the dark. The full beam was amazing. It was like lighting a film set. You turned on full beam and you just, whoa, what's all that? But you couldn't have full beam on and the windscreen wipers, because if you had full beam on and the windscreen wipers, the fuse blew. So I was making quite a lot of like, complicated late-night decisions if it was raining, what exactly I was going to favour here. If you went downhill for too long, there was something about the way the petrol was getting into the engine that meant it would cut out. So the petrol wasn't completely full. And so coming down the M11, there's quite a long period where you're going downhill and it's the exit for the M25. So you have to be over in the middle lane and it would reliably cut out at some point on that. And you couldn't just pull over because that was the entrance to the M25. And it's the sort of thing you do in your early 20s and think, cool, look at this. Now how did it not die? How did it not kill me? And also, this is the final thing. The first time, I hadn't driven much, but I was used to cars that by the time you got to E on the fuel gauge, that was like, okay, now you need to get petrol, but you've got a little bit to get you there.
Yeah.
The first time I got to E on the Hugo, I thought, well, you know, there's a petrol station 2 miles away. I'll be fine. No, it got to E and it just stopped. That was it. E was the end. That was the bottom of it.
I told you.
It had very little to recommend it. And also, sorry, I've missed this bit out. To start it, because the brushes and the engine weren't very, would stick. So when you started it, you had to open the hood. And then had two bits of wood, which we carried in the car. One was very long, one was short and thick. And you had to put the long one down so it was resting on where the engine brushes are sitting. And you then hit it with a shorter piece of wood, which loosened the brushes enough that you could run around, turn the engine and it would start.
Oh, wow.
The one thing I would say, you could mend lots of things about it yourself. It's a very easy engine. For example, right. You could hit it with bits of wood to make it work. And I don't know if my current car would be quite so tolerant of that, but it really was. How we survived it, I don't know. And I can't imagine that I had a particularly unusually bad one. I just think they weren't great vehicles.
No. It is weird, though, isn't it, when you think back on cars that you've owned and what you'll put up with. You say, why? Why am I doing one? This should be scrapped. I mean, I had a Fiat that, to begin with, the brakes didn't really work. I mean, at the beginning of a journey, they needed to warm up.
Yeah.
So so for the first sort of mile or so, as I was driving along, I would be constantly pumping the brake to warm it up. Otherwise, if I'd had to do a sudden stop, it wouldn't have happened. And I drove like this for about a year. It's mad.
The car, I was after the Hugo, I inherited Tom's brother's Lada, which was presumably, until its next MOT, it was held together with gaffer tape. And the steering, you just couldn't, you just remember, I'm going around a corner. You had to put on about like two locks to get it to go around a corner at all. It was extraordinary. And I thought I was driving a Mercedes compared to the Yugo. I was like, look at this glamour.
Yeah. And look, leather seats, marvellous. <I know. laughs> All patched up. Oh, my word. Well, are there Yugos in the world now?
You very rarely see them.
Mm. I wonder why.
I can't imagine. I think it's one of the Die Hard films. I think it might be Die Hard 3. Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson are trying to escape or chase a baddie or something. They're doing it in a Yugo. And Bruce Willis is shouting, make it go faster. And Samuel L. Jackson's going, it's built for economy, not for speed. The kindest thing I've ever heard anybody say about a Yugo.
Oh, right. Well, let's put that dreadful car into the time capsule. We should bury it and nobody will have to ever drive one again. Fantastic.
It got graffitied. It looked like, even when I was driving it, it looked like it was going to go into the bin. People just write on it.
At least it was a van. If you needed space, you had it. That was something. But no, it's gone in there. Okay, so Sophie, we've just got one final thing that you want to put in and keep.
My last thing to put in and keep, and I accept this is a large thing to put into a time capsule, but I would like to put Blackpool into the time capsule.
Are you from near there or there, in fact?
I am. I'm from Blackburn, just as well, from being about 16 miles away from Blackpool. Yeah. And my parents are from the south, and we moved up to, this shows my age, we moved up to the north because my father worked in a carpet factory, and Blackburn was near the carpet factory, which is in Rishton. Mm. And my mother was always a bit like, oh, Lincolnshire. But my father was like, we are near Blackpool. We are near Blackpool. And Blackpool, for his generation, was like, oh, we're near Las Vegas, you know. Yeah. He was a massive fan of comedy. And it's still the case that comedians will still always play Blackpool. And in the 60s and 70s, it was still absolutely in its heyday for that.
Yeah.
And I can remember my outrage when they went to see what was, I think, Morecambe and Wise's last tour. And I wasn't allowed to go. And they were getting all dressed up. And I was to go see them at the Opera House. And I was, oh, the jealousy still overwhelms me. So there was the comedy side of Blackpool, but also, you know, I love it as a place to go. It's a spectacular location. I mean, it's just got miles and miles of beach.
Yes.
I accept it's looking out onto the Irish Sea, but it's, you know, it's a spectacular beach. You've got three piers. You've got the tower, which is just glorious. I absolutely love Blackpool Tower. And it's got Blackpool Pleasure Beach, which I absolutely love. So again, my father's favourite thing to do as a sort of a day out would be to go to Blackpool and go on the first day of the season, and everything's opening up and everything's sort of running and the stall holders are opening up their stalls. And what he liked to do, because you just used to be able to walk into it. You didn't have to pay to go in. It was just there by the beach and you wandered in. You have to pay to go on rides, but you could walk around. And what he didn't particularly want to pay for us all to go on all the rides, but he would pay for us to go into the fun house because you only paid once to go into the fun house. And then you've got all the insane slides your heart might. There was really dangerous things in there. And in fact, very symbolically, when he retired and left the UK, it burnt down. Yeah, it's like Harry's War. But I still go back. My son was born in London. And when he turned about three, I was like, he needs to see the Blackpool Illuminations.
Right.
It's important that he sees this.
Yeah.
And on that trip, where we got to go on an illuminated tram, it was amazing. I also took him to the Pleasure Beach for the first time. And now we go very often. He really enjoys it. He likes fun fairs. He likes theme parks. And if you like those things, then I have to say, Blackpool is one of the best places in the world. Disney World is based on Blackpool Pleasure Beach. I mean, it really is a phenomenal place. So I go as often as I can do, and I would love to see more people going there because it's a great destination and it needs our business.
Yes. Yeah, you're right, it does. It is an extraordinary emblem of a time, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
The fact that working population from Manchester and Liverpool and Leeds and Blackburn, as you said, that whole, right across the country, you've got this mass of people all working. And there they have this place that they can go. And everybody did.
Yes. It's one of my favourite films is a film about the Wakes Weeks in Blackburn. And Wakes Weeks were when the mills closed.
Right.
The whole town at a time would have its Wakes Weeks. My father got Wakes Weeks holidays because you just close the factory or a mill all at once. And then everybody would decamp normally to Blackpool.
Yeah.
And all of Blackburn is closing and everybody's getting all these trains running out and going off to stay in all the little guest houses. And it's spectacularly evocative. And it's within living memory. As I say, my father got Wakes Weeks holidays. Yes. You used to be able to tell in Blackpool, like, when's it Wakes Weeks, because that would be who else was in there. Like, it's Wakes Weeks is now in Glasgow because the place is full of Glaswegians. And you still do see that. You see a lot when you're in Blackpool, you'll see a lot of people from Scotland who've come down to have a break.
Yeah.
So it's still doing well, but I'd love to see more people visit it. If Margate was like Blackpool, it would be overrun.
Yeah, it would be. And Margate isn't like Blackpool.
No, it's great. It's got no disrespect to Margate, but Blackpool is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Free enormous as well. It's absolutely enormous. Yeah, it's fantastic. I hadn't been there for many years, and then I went there quite recently and just walked along the front, you know, about 2 hour walk.
Yeah.
And you look at this enormous, beautiful sandy beach.
Yeah.
And think, if only this had Mediterranean weather.
Yes. on a good day, I accept it's not always a good day, but you look up the beach and you'll see at the far end, you can see the Lake District. And you look down the other way and you can see North Wales. Yeah. You know, it's a beautiful coast.
Yes.
The Fylde coast and going up. And it is all at Morecambe, also lovely. I mean, it is really lovely. Mm. But there's something really kind of breathtaking about the scale of what you can see from Blackpool.
Yeah. And unlike Blackburn, no holes. Full of holes. I heard that on a record once, apparently.
You know, one of the things that I've never seen anybody discuss, but people from Blackburn tended to be very aware of, there's another layer to that joke. So they read this thing about 4,000 holes in Blackburn Lake. Is it 4,000, 2,000? It's a lot of holes in Blackburn.
Yeah, I was trying to remember the number, but yeah, I think it is 4,000.
But there's another layer to that joke, which I think you only get if you are from the Northwest, which is that people from Liverpool thought that people from Lancashire in general were sort of simpleton rural individuals. They called us woolly backs. And people from Lancashire, so I grew up thinking that Liverpudlian accent was extremely kind of sophisticated and rather, you know, yeah. I moved south, I found people who thought it sounded a bit kind of, you know, I'm a scallion, I'm going to have your car kind of thing. So I think one of the reasons why that's in there is it would have been funny that it was Blackburn to John Lennon, because Blackburn and Lancashire was funny and silly and a bit sort of thick and rural. So there's a joke at Blackburn's expense in there, I think.
Right. There you are. But not Blackpool. What a place. Fantastic. Yeah, I have ridden a donkey on the beach.
Oh, excellent.
I have danced on the floor of the ballroom. So
the ballroom. I remember dragging Tom to Blackpool. It would have been in the Yugo. We drove there in the Yugo. Oh, man. and we went into the Tower Ballroom. And we were just sitting around the... Because people just turn up and dance. And they turn up and, you know, different people play the organ and they announce what the next dance would be. And they announce the next dance was going to be a cha-cha-cha. And there was a kerfuffle at the side of the room. And there was a woman dragging a man. And he was like, no, no, no. And she's going, come on, come on. He's like, no, no, no. And she hauled him onto the stage, at which point he threw himself into the most disinhibited cha-cha-cha I've ever seen. Like, really went for it. And the two of them, I thought, I never want this to end. This is the best dance I've ever seen. I'm the happiest I've ever been watching dance. It was glorious, just glorious.
Glorious.
Very Blackpool.
Fantastic. Well, it's been glorious talking to you, Sophie. It's been absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
Thank you so much for being on this.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed that. Thank you.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Sophie Scott. Thank you for listening. Hopefully, like me, if you've listened to a few of these, then you'll have worked out that it's nice to hear famous people, but it's not always the most famous who are the most interesting, as Sophie has just demonstrated. If you had fun, then tell your friends, relatives, and people next to you at the bus stop, and do rate or review this podcast. You can also subscribe to get every episode as they're released. If you find the adverts annoying, then for a small fee, you can get this podcast ad-free and get a bonus episode every week, all about what's happening with the podcast and some behind-the-scenes secrets. You just have to subscribe to Acast Plus, and you can discover how to do that by reading the bump in the description of this episode. You'll also find a link to Sophie's book. The theme tune is available to download or stream on Spotify, and it was written and performed by the very talented Pass the Peas Music. Do follow me and My Time Capsule on social media. We're very friendly, I promise. And finally, this was a cast-off production for Acast, produced by John Fenton Stevens. Right, as we've been talking about minds and brains and all that, I thought I'd leave you with a joke for all you mind readers out there. Yes, good, isn't it? Bye.